At the Academy Awards Sunday night, funny man Bill Murray gave a shout out to his friend and collaborator Harold Ramis. Murray and Ramis had worked together on Ghostbusters, Stripes, and Groundhog Day. Ramis, the actor, writer, director, died last Monday at age 69 from the effects of autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis. In this hour of midday, Dr. John Smarr explains what that is. We'll also hear about diseases that can go undiagnosed and untreated. And Dr. Smarr lists the warning signs for diabetes, which affects 1 in 10 Baltimoreans, according to the City Health Department. It's Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr of Sinai Hospital, coming up after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. On today's Midday on Health, we take a look at some of the diseases that go undiagnosed or are hard to diagnose and how best to detect them before complications arise. Recent studies have shown that hepatitis C and lupus are more common than initially thought, and some infected people are unaware that they have contracted a life-threatening illness. The always controversial Lyme disease is still mystifying to some in the medical community. Another condition that has the medical community torn a bit, fibromyalgia syndrome, is said to affect up to 3% of the general population. Because its cause is poorly understood, some in the medical community question the legitimacy of fibromyalgia syndrome diagnoses, a disease linked to sleep problems and mood disorders and general body pain. Also, NBC's The Today Show has selected Baltimore for its public service campaign, a year-long campaign to improve the health and fitness of city residents. The popular morning network show chose Baltimore partially due to the rate of diabetes here, which affects 1 in 10 Baltimoreans, according to the city health department. Today on the show, we're going to examine some of the warning signs associated with the condition with diabetes. Of course, a healthy diet, regular exercise are the best forms of diabetes prevention, but new research surrounding a rare genetic mutation suggests that there might be effective diabetes treatment within the next decade or so. We'll talk about that and tell you about that, too. We're also going to take a look at autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis. That's a rare disease that the effects of which last week claimed the life of a comedian icon Harold Ramis, a director, writer, actor Harold Ramis, well-known to many people from Ghostbusters, from Stripes. Symptoms of this rare condition can take years to manifest. We thought we'd find out about it today, and here to help us with it, of course, Midday on Health's contributor, Dr. John Smarr, infectious diseases physician at Sinai Hospital of Baltimore, who joins us on the first Monday of every month for Midday on Health. John, nice to see you again.
Wonderful to see you, even with the weather outside, Dan.
I'm glad you got here. Thank you very much.
I am too.
Harold Ramis, Bill Murray did a shout-out to him last night at the Academy Awards. Just seemed like a nice guy from everything you read about him. But at the age of 69, he died a week ago today from the effects of this autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis. That's a mouthful. But I thought we'd hear from you about that. First of all, that word, autoimmune disease, autoimmune disorder, it's become commonly used, autoimmune, and I'm not sure everybody understands what that means.
Right, and that's actually a very important thing to talk about, especially with some of the other things we may get to this hour. Like, for instance, celiac disease. Some people often describe as, oh, there's a gluten allergy, but actually there's a difference between having an allergic reaction to something and having an autoimmune problem. And so what an autoimmune problem is that for some reason, and there are many, many of these autoimmune disorders and different precipitating things involved with each, but for some reason, a specific part of our immune systems sort of gets mistargeted, because the whole point of our immune system is it's trying to identify, okay, these cells, these components of our body, this is us, this is safe, we want to protect this, so we're trying to identify viruses or bacteria or other things that the immune system can then break down, deal with, and get out of our body. And so there are sort of ways on the microscopic scale that our body figures out which is us and which is not us. That's sort of the basic way that often they explain it. And okay, what happens is that in these autoimmune disorders, part of the immune system essentially gets mistargeted, and it identifies some aspect of us as being not us, and it starts reacting to a specific component of our body that it shouldn't be reacting to, and then it causes, obviously, illness, damage, and other problems.
So then the illness becomes chronic. Is that right?
Right. It can be, but it's important to know with a lot of these things, including the autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis, other things like lupus, many other diseases. A lot of people have the experience where it's a chronic thing, but it's a chronic thing that has... It remits and relapses, as we would say in the medical world. So you have sort of times when you're feeling sick and having symptoms from it, or it's causing problems, and times when you don't. In some people, they can last for a long time and not cause any problems. And in other people, they just sort of, for lack of a better phrase, burn themselves out. So you can have it for a period of time, and then for whatever combination of reasons, it stops being a problem for you. And obviously, that's a great thing.
All right. Then speak, John, would you, specifically about this disease, autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis that affected Harold Ramis.
Right. Egon, my favorite Ghostbuster.
From Ghostbuster.
So sad,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about this is that if you see in the media when they're talking, when they have such a cumbersome phrase like autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis, the whole point of when we're trying to effectively communicate things, we're trying to distill it down to be simple. So that means if we're using this cumbersome three-word phrase, that means the reality must be much more complex than that. And the truth of the matter is that this is actually not just one thing, but it's a collection of many, many different types of specific diseases that have all sorts of different effects. And I did a little bit of research online in terms of just the media reporting. And so as far as I can tell, I couldn't figure out, and I don't know that it's been reported, what specifically he unfortunately had and died from.
Okay.
But essentially...
But generally speaking,
it's good to examine what the words are. So we already talked about autoimmune. Mm-hmm. Inflammatory means inflammation. That means the immune system is responding. You're getting extra cells into a specific area that, say, if you have an infection, or in this case, an area of the body that doesn't have a problem. And essentially, it causes damage because it's like almost a war zone, because these cells and other things are essentially trying to eliminate a bad thing. Vasculitis, that word, essentially means irritation or inflammation of a vascular structure, or in layman's terms, a blood vessel. So this could be everything from tiny capillaries on the surface of your skin all the way up to the biggest blood vessels in our body, such as the aorta, the big tube that comes from the heart. And so there are many, many different kinds of this vasculitis, and they've got all sorts of funky names. Probably the one, some of the ones that people may have heard of, the one that affects the aorta is something called Takayasu arteritis. These are named after people who discovered them or people who had them, and that affects the aorta. There's another one that's called temporal arteritis because it affects the arteries at our temples. And this goes from big blood vessels down to little ones. And essentially, the course of all of these is vaguely similar in the sense that what happens is, what this inflammation does is it attacks the wall of the blood vessel, the wall of the tube, and causes damage to that. And so what can happen is these can get harder. They can narrow. You can have clots form so that blood doesn't travel as well as it should. And especially you can think that if it happens in the brain, this could, say, have many effects such as a stroke. The other thing is that it can weaken the walls of these vessels. So if you think about a balloon, if you have a balloon and you blow it up, it's round. But if you ever have a balloon that has a little area of weakness on it and you blow it up, you can see that that area bulges out. Well, that can actually happen with the blood vessels too, which can cause its own host of problems, such as risk for rupturing, more blood clots, and things like that. And like I said before, a lot of these, sometimes it's a long-term thing, but you tend to have episodes where they're worse and episodes where they're better.
So that is given as the cause of death for a famous, pretty well-known writer, director, actor, Harold Ramis. But you don't know from your reading of the press the coverage of his death, specifically what symptoms he had, what inflammations he experienced.
Exactly.
But you know generally that inflammation of the vascular system in some way. And how might it have manifested? How does a person feel? What How does it affect the body?
So
you have trouble breathing, for
right?
Instance?
It depends on what vessels are involved. So it could be almost anything, and so you could imagine that, for instance, I mentioned before, temporal arteritis. So it occurs in the arteries in your temples. Your temples get very tender. You have very severe headaches. You can have eye problems. If it's affecting the lungs, sometimes you can have cough and respiratory symptoms, coughing up blood. People can have kidney damage. There are many of these that involve the kidneys. Skin neurologic problems, if it's involving the brain. Again, it really runs a very broad gamut of different things.
So to actually have the diagnosis of autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis, it would have to be something that was not episodic, something that was in your system, the doctor could diagnose it saying, yes, this is autoimmune.
Right. And so that's a very good point, is the question of, well, if I'm worried about this or I'm having symptoms, how does a healthcare person figure out that you have this? Part of it, of course, as with many things in medicine, is figuring out the pattern recognition. We know, we're trained to look for, okay, if someone has a certain amount of symptoms over a certain time, well, that means I need to think about this. There are some blood tests that you can do that are fairly non-specific, in the sense that you do them, and if they're positive, it doesn't tell you, yes, this is the specific diagnosis, but this can suggest to you, okay, there's an autoimmune process that's going on. In a lot of these cases, though, the thing that is definite for the diagnosis is you actually have to do a biopsy. You have to get a chunk of the blood vessel, in this case, and look at it under a microscope. And there are certain patterns that the pathologist can look at and tell you, this looks like an autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis.
One of the things we're looking at today is diseases you might not know you have. This one you would know you'd have.
That's true. And I mean, you could have with this is not something that you would be, say, silent for a long time, meaning asymptomatic with. It would be hard to do a study to figure out, say, how long someone had the underlying process going on before they were diagnosed. But really, you would start to have symptoms, and that's how people end up going through this workup of getting diagnosed.
John Smarr, our guest, as always, on the first Monday of every month with Midday on Health. We're going to take our first break here, but when we get back, we have a list of diseases we're going to go through, diseases you might not know you have because they are not diagnosed, hard to diagnose, and go untreated in some cases. We'll be taking our short break, our first break here. We'll be right back for more Midday on Health. And welcome back. It's Midday on Health. Dan Rodericks with Dr. John Smarr. Before we leave Harold Ramis behind and the effects of autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis that contributed to his death, I didn't ask you about treatments for it. The diagnosis doesn't mean it's not a death sentence. You can apparently live with this for a while, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the unusual thing, and who knows the accuracy of what we're hearing, but it's at least what I saw in a New York Times article was saying that it was about maybe 4 years that people believe he was living with this diagnosis. And so that would be a less typical case, because usually nowadays with a lot of the medicines, and the mainstay of treatment is using steroids like mm-hmm. prednisone. Hmm. So it feels a little bit unusual to me for the fact that unfortunately, if it really was 4 years from him being diagnosed to unfortunately dying, that's not the typical experience of most patients. But yeah, steroids are like prednisone is the main drug that reduces inflammation and irritation in the body. So that's sort of the mainstay of treatment for a lot of these. There are sometimes cases that are severe enough that steroids may not work for some people. And then you have to use other drugs that do different things to the immune system, even things that you would consider to be used as chemotherapy for certain cancers, because it's trying to regulate the immune system to control this disorder. And that's another big problem with folks who unfortunately have one of these disorders, is the fact that you're having to deal with the side effects from the medications. Steroids have an impressive number of side effects. Many of these other medications, if steroids don't work, it's the same, similar situation. And so that can be a very, very challenging thing.
John Smarr, our guest in this hour of Midday on Health. And John, we're going to talk about diseases you might not know you have. And I guess some of our listeners, when they hear me say that, they'll say, well, what do you mean diseases I might not know I have? How could I have a disease and not know I have it? I would be sick. I would have symptoms. I would, you know, run off to a doctor and get a test and be diagnosed. But it's possible to have a disease and not be aware of it.
Right. And you know, when you look at that tagline, which I think is a great tagline, but simultaneously, it sounds a little bit scary. And
alarmist. Yeah. We don't want to be alarmist.
Right. And we don't want to be alarmist. And right. I think that's the key thing. Yeah. We're talking about a disease that someone could be have going on inside of their body, but either they feel perfectly fine, or maybe they have some vague symptoms that they chalk up to something else, life, stress, things like that. Of course, the challenge, and why we don't want to be alarmist by going over this, is that there are lots of excellent reasons why many of us walk around with vague symptoms like fatigue, other things like that, that don't pretend that we have one of these things inside of us as a disease.
All right, let's start with one of these things. Let's start with hepatitis C.
Sure.
Okay, I mean, I read a piece by Jane Brody, New York Times, saying that there was an estimate of some 3.2 million Americans possibly who are carrying hepatitis C and are unaware of it.
Right. And so hepatitis C is one of these big health issues in terms of the other. So hepatitis C is a specific virus. Again, getting down to what the words mean, hepatitis as a word means irritation or inflammation of the liver. So something is causing a problem with your liver. Everyone has probably heard of or is aware, either through vaccines or news or school, that there are different types of viruses that can affect the liver. And we decided, for whatever reason, to give them letters. So there's hepatitis A, which is usually a food poisoning thing that doesn't cause chronic disease. So it's not something you get that stays with you for the rest of your life. The two other big ones, though, are B and C, which are notable because they can cause a chronic infection of your liver, meaning the virus, once you're exposed to it, lives in your liver, it makes more copies of itself. And the concern about that is that for both of these, but especially with hepatitis C, that you can have this for a number of years, maybe even decades, without really feeling any symptoms. And what that can ultimately result in potentially is either your liver stops working, liver failure, because you have so much liver damage from this virus, or rarely, you can get liver cancer, because any situation in which you have inflammation or irritation is a setup for your body's cells to potentially mutate or change and become cancerous.
John, what's the difference between B and C?
It's two different viruses. And to break it down in a very, very simple way, it turns out that B is one that we were able to more easily make a vaccine for. This seems like a silly way to break it down, but it turns out it was easier for us to figure out a vaccine that will take care of hepatitis B. And so now kids get that. Adults, that's something that you screen for. So for instance, for an adult, if you work in any sort of healthcare field, you get screened for hepatitis A and hepatitis B, meaning do you have antibodies to that. And if you don't, and you don't have any evidence of having this hepatitis B as a chronic infection, we can give you a series of vaccines to protect you. So the thought is that, say, healthcare workers are more likely in the line of duty to be exposed to blood or another body fluid from someone who has it. And so you want to protect yourself with a vaccine so that you don't get the infection yourself. Other groups of people, such as folks who have HIV, that's someone that we screen for these different types of hepatitis.
So those are risk groups, right?
Right. So this is your saying that it's less worried about the protection and more a little bit worried that it could be a more severe disease in people who have other medical problems like HIV. Now, as I mentioned, though, the issue with hepatitis C, among many others, one, it is very hard to treat, although that there's a lot of exciting news over the last 6 months about that to a year. And two, we actually don't have a vaccine that we can give to protect people from it.
Now, you mentioned before the potential for it causing liver damage. So let's say you're infected, it's undetected, you're not aware that you have hepatitis C. Is it doing, could it be doing damage to your liver while it remains undetected. Is that your point?
Yeah, very likely, yes. That's the ultimate point, because the virus is not sort of stalled out. What it's doing is it makes more copies of itself. And how it does that is it does that inside of liver cells. And as a byproduct of doing that, it kills off some of those liver cells.
And if you go to your doctor once a year for your annual exam and you have a blood test, hepatitis C would show up in the course of a blood test?
It is likely so. It is not currently a routine recommended test to screen absolutely everyone specifically with the antibody test for hepatitis C. But it turns out that most people who have this as a chronic infection, you have some irritation of your liver. And a couple of the basic blood tests that, say, your physician might do on you, if you're having a physical, like a general physical, do a blood count. They check your blood tests for kidneys, and they check blood tests for your liver function. And often people who have a chronic hepatitis C infection will have a couple of those blood tests that are just a little bit high, a little bit out of the normal range. And so if you see that, one of the things that's then important for the healthcare provider to do, depending on everything else that's going on, is to screen that person just to make sure they don't have specifically hepatitis B or hepatitis C.
I mentioned the figure 3.2 million people in the United States infected with hepatitis C. I'm getting that from a Jane Brody piece in which she's quoting Dr. Mark Sulkowski, who is a liver specialist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He says an estimated 3.2 million people in the United States are infected, but the vast majority of them don't know it. And it can be transmitted.
Right. And so this is something that's primarily transmitted through blood exposure. So, for instance, especially in Baltimore, sharing intravenous drug use, specifically sharing dirty needles, is probably the biggest exposure. Other things like sexual exposure can transmit it, but at a much lower potential rate. The greatest risk is through blood exposure.
During our talk about hepatitis C, John, a moment ago you mentioned HIV. I see HIV is on your list of diseases you may not know and be unaware of.
Right, and that's sort of the huge key thing about public health efforts dealing with HIV, is that when someone is first exposed to the virus, a lot of people will feel sort of acutely sick, like they have a viral illness, like they have influenza, something like that. Then it goes away. And then you can have HIV in your body and feel completely 100% fine with no symptoms for years. The problem is that the virus is there, it's in your body, and so if you are having unprotected sex with other people, you could transmit that virus to other people. And so that's been the biggest frustration, apart from the piece of figuring out the best way, once we've identified that somebody has the virus, to treat them, is what do we do about the substantial proportion of people who don't even know that they're infected? And that's why there are these big campaigns. I mean, around Baltimore, you even see signs on the sides of buses, you see them on billboards. And there are many, many different ways that we've tried to reach out to different communities to say, hey, the most responsible thing to do is to get tested, because if you get tested and you're positive, that's something we can deal with. It's something that if we get you on therapy, you're going to live a very likely long, normal, healthy life. And that way, we can prevent that from being spread to other people, because you know, and hopefully are adopting, even if they weren't there before, healthier sexual habits and lifestyle habits that will prevent that.
I see the signs on the sides of buses, MTA buses, about getting tested. I've been seeing them for years. Are we making any progress in terms of getting more people tested?
That is a very, very challenging piece. And the answer to that is a little bit. I think that's fair, but not dramatically. Because when we try to figure out, well, if we're doing this type of a public educational campaign, what are the ways we're going to figure out that we're being successful? And the idea is that ultimately, by testing people, getting them into treatment, counseling about safe sex practices and things like that, then hopefully we should see over a period of years that the incidence of new cases of HIV, if you track them, should be going down. And that has not been, we have not seen a tremendous decrease in the number of cases of HIV that we're diagnosing from year to year. And that's why, and I think we've even mentioned it on the show in the past, a couple of years ago, there was the first approved treatment from the FDA, the pill that was approved to actually do pre-exposure prophylaxis, meaning that if somebody knows they're going to go into a high-risk situation, that they can take this pill to try to prevent getting HIV, because even public health education, while very, very important, when you look at the statistics, whatever we're doing so far, it's not effective enough yet to completely make a huge dent in the incidence and the transmission of HIV.
Let me add another layer to this, John. This is from last month, the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics, JAMA Pediatrics. This study finding that 1/3 to nearly half of American teens and young adults with HIV delayed treatment until their infection is advanced, putting them at greater risk for serious health problems. These findings are especially disturbing, it says, as evidence increasingly suggests that starting HIV treatment as soon as possible helps keep the virus under control and can prevent the heart, kidney, and neurological harm that occurs in patients with poorly controlled HIV infection.
That is a very, very prescient statement and very important to recognize. The challenge is that, one, with regards to the initiation of early treatment, we actually have very good data now that shows that even though HIV attacks specific cells in your immune system, and if someone has AIDS as a result of HIV, you're at risk for getting certain infections that people with normal healthy immune systems can't deal with. We also now know that over the long term, if somebody has an HIV infection that's untreated, you actually have an increased risk of things that aren't infections, but getting back to something I mentioned earlier, are a result of the fact that you've got all this inflammation and this infection, which comes with it a little bit of inflammation in your body. So stroke, so heart attack, so kidney disease. And so now we have more and more data saying, if we get the goal, I think ultimately what we're going to see is most, if not all people, the recommendation is going to be we really need to get them on treatment as soon as possible. But this key demographic, the young teen demographic, especially those who are men who have sex with men, that population, there are many challenges there with regards to getting them even tested, because the concern is, in some areas of society, still a big cultural stigma,
right.
And there's fear about that. There's fear about seeing with the medications, even.
So you need to have a specific test, because this goes back to my question about the annual exam. If you're good about seeing your doctor once a year, and you have a blood test, on HIV?
So HIV, I'm very happy that the CDC a few years ago came out with their universal screening recommendations, which they're essentially saying that if you're of the teenage years up to age 65, and me personally, I wouldn't age restrict it at all, that you should at least once make sure someone is screened for HIV. And I think it's very important that doctors are, as we would say, taking a sexual history. Well, in other words, when we're doing the whole physical and the history, that we should be asking about sexual practices, new sexual partners, if somebody's relationship changes, because those might be another indicator to say, okay, if you have a new relationship, you're not always using condoms when you're having sexual encounters. Or if you're engaged in high-risk things, then maybe I need to be screening you again, or maybe I need to do HIV testing every 6 months.
Is it not part of a regular blood test, or do you have to ask for it specifically?
It's part. Well, all of these blood tests are very fine. And that's actually a great question, because it addresses sort of when people say, okay, is there a regular panel of blood tests
where
I go and see
my
doctor?
What are you being screened for when your doctor says draw some blood, the nurse draws some blood at your annual physical?
Right. In some ways, it depends on the doctor. It depends really on, there are guidelines and recommendations depending what gender you are, what age you are,
You just said your sexual profile, for instance.
Right, yeah. Hmm. So I would say that most people, when they think of doing a physical, and probably most physicians, when they come into it saying, okay, this is a healthy, well adult, what might I screen for? They would check a complete blood count to see if you're anemic or other things. They would check your kidney function. They may check your liver function. They may check your cholesterol level. Sometimes they may do a urine test just to see if there are any abnormalities. And again, the whole reason for doing this is you're trying to do very basic, cheap, inexpensive tests to look for things, for obvious signs that there might be a big problem down the road.
I understand. But given the AIDS epidemic in the world, HIV, I would assume that that would have become part of the regular panel of testing, of screenings that's done in blood tests.
I would say absolutely it has not. Hmm. And I think that depending on the situation, it should be. And for some people, I do, because, you know, again, it comes into history. We're not at a point yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. You say depending on the situation, meaning depending on the sexual profile of the patient, right?
Right, right.
But there's stigma attached. There's people aren't always as candid with their doctors as you think they might be.
Right. And the other key thing is that, and this gets very frustrating. Like, for instance, if you ask me, I think that it is completely reasonable, especially in high prevalence areas like Baltimore, to consider testing everybody for HIV. I think that that is a reasonable thing to consider. But you also have to understand, of course, the history, as we all know, of the stigma surrounding HIV and HIV testing, and also what the state of Maryland law is. It used to be, up until a few years ago, that there was a separate consent form that you had to do with the patient and they had to sign off on, that went over sort of, you had to go through this regimen, this script of explaining, okay, this is pre-test counseling is what they called it. And so you had to go through all these bullet points so that someone understood what the test was, what a negative result means, what a positive result means. And then when you get the result back, no matter what it is, you would also have to do something called post-test counseling, meaning that you are required to go through another sort of scripted list of, again, what the result means and put it into context. No longer is there this consent form over the last few years. And of course, that was, to me, that seemed like a very Stone Age, barbaric thing that still had persisted. But there still is a need to actually document, if you're in the hospital in the progress note, if you're in the outpatient setting in the progress note, legally you're supposed to document, in order to do the test, that you discussed it with the patient, that you did this counseling, and that they agreed to the test.
Okay. Thank you very much for that explanation, John. I'm a little surprised to hear that, but thank you very much. I wasn't aware of that. We're going to take another break here on Midday on Health. Well, there's a lot of things I'm not aware of that I learned on Midday on Health with John Smarr. When we get back, some more diseases that you might not know you have, and then we're going to have to talk a little bit about diabetes too, John. Short break on Midday on Health. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here with Dr. John Smarr. So, John, can you have lupus and not know it? And what is lupus?
Right. So lupus is another one of these disorders that falls sort of in the autoimmune type of a category. And as with many of these, there are certain aspects of it that are kind of mysterious. And in fact, the joke is a common joke in many, many television shows or movies, like, for instance, House, whenever they're doing the procedure where they're sitting down, they're doing the what we would call the differential diagnosis. You're coming up with the list of all the different diagnoses, and they always put lupus on there, and they say, yeah, but it's never lupus. And then there was one episode of House where it was lupus. And it's because it's mostly unexplained. The idea that, for the most part, people who have lupus may have vague things, and you're talking about fever and fatigue and weight loss, but most people who truly have it as an active issue, you're not running around asymptomatic with these, so you're at least feeling sick in a certain way. But the problem is, and I even have the list in front of me, because it is a daunting list. Lupus can affect pretty much any organ system. It can do so many different things. It can affect your kidneys. One of the typical things that it does, so there's something called a lupus nephritis, nephro meaning kidney, itis meaning inflammation. One of the classic hallmarks that people think about is that you get what we call a photosensitive rash, meaning you go out in the sun and you get a rash. And there you can have arthritis, you can have other, you can actually have autoimmune vasculitis as a result or associated with lupus. And so it can be connected to many other different things.
Does this make it difficult to diagnose?
It does make it somewhat difficult to diagnose, because again, if you have someone who's coming in with certain more vague symptoms like being tired, weight loss, obviously there are many, many things that can do that. But if someone comes in with that, and then they're also having, you do a blood test and you say you see a problem with the kidney, and then they also say, you know, I'm having this rash whenever I go out into the sunlight, well, that's enough of a pattern to start making you think about lupus. There are blood tests, again, that you can do. They aren't entirely specific to the disease, meaning there is not one lupus test that gives you a yes or no in 100% of the cases. But essentially you're looking at this pattern of thing. There are criteria that you can look at that have been developed, and that will sort of lead you down the pathway to saying, yes, this is lupus.
So it sounds like that pathway can be a long pathway sometimes.
Right, yes.
Take time.
Yeah, and again, the treatment for that is steroids, and of course there are other specialized medications after that that if the steroids don't necessarily work, and it's something that you have times when you have flares. People talk about having a lupus flare, meaning they have an exacerbation of symptoms, and then there are times when you're not symptomatic.
I want to ask you about two of these together, fibromyalgia and Lyme disease, because I've heard them associated. I'll tell you how in a moment. But first, fibromyalgia syndrome. I guess this is somewhat controversial still.
You mentioned both of those in the same sentence.
They're both controversial. Well, I'll tell you why. Back when I was doing a lot of reading about Lyme disease and understanding the controversy associated with it, and actually we had a couple of midday shows devoted to that subject here, and I've written some columns about it. I remember some doctors telling me that the best diagnosis they could come up with for some patients who believed they had Lyme disease was fibromyalgia.
Correct.
General body pain, bone pains in the back, pains in the arms, sensitive to the touch of the skin, and just couldn't accept that this generally would be diagnosed as fibromyalgia and not Lyme disease, because there was no proof of having been bitten by a tick.
Exactly.
That's my contribution on that.
Right. And of course, the other big pieces of fibromyalgia people often talk about is problems sleeping associated cognitive difficulties.
Right.
And what I think is becoming, I don't think that there are still some people, I would say some well-informed medical professionals, who would say that fibromyalgia does not exist as a thing. I think for the most part, though, it's clear that there is something to the idea of there's obviously something organic that's going on. And the issue is that it's probably not just one thing. If you take two different fibromyalgia patients, it's very likely there could be different factors. So it's almost like we're trying to lump together, because it's the best way we know how when we're describing things, people who may have a bunch of different reasons why they're all in some ways feeling the same way and having similar symptoms. So there's thoughts that it could have genetic, it's like multiple factors as to why people get it. You could have a genetic association. In fact, it seems like that there is an increased prevalence of people who have fibromyalgia, who have certain mutations in genes that are actually associated with having other things in sort of the psychiatric axis, such as major depressive disorder. There's an associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. Again, I'm not saying these are causative, and I'm not saying these are always 100% together, but these are very powerful associations that we see, and it sort of informs how we take our approach to diagnosing and working with those patients and treating those patients.
Does it come up that, some patients want a diagnosis, they go to a doctor, they have some general pain, a doctor isn't convinced that they have a chronic condition of any kind or autoimmune disorder, and they want something, so they get fibromyalgia because it sounds good?
Right. And so this really gets into this is, I would say, well, for me, my skewed perspective being infectious diseases, I often see folks who they are sick. This is not diminishing in any way how they're feeling, but they're coming in. And a lot of times it's they have pain. They have cognitive difficulties, difficulty sleeping, this list of things. And unfortunately, this sort of constellation of a bunch of different nonspecific symptoms has been associated with things like Lyme disease. It has been associated with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. And so in some ways, it's the people want to be diagnosed and want to be treated and want to get better. But to some degree, some people think it's very important that they're able to get a label.
Right.
For a one-word label, right, or a one-phrase label to describe their symptoms.
I remember speaking with some people who believe they were infected with Lyme disease, who felt that they faced a harsh judgment, or maybe the word is distrust, of doctors who just don't believe that chronic Lyme disease exists, and gave them the best diagnosis, I say, fibromyalgia for some general pain and fatigue and some insomnia.
Right, absolutely. And I think that the challenge, and we've even talked about it here before, is that a lot of physicians are very, I think it's always sort of, it requires patience and very good communication to be when a physician and a patient are discussing this as a possibility. And I think sometimes physicians sort of get burned out, or they don't have a lot of time. Burned out, I mean, on talking on the subject, or aren't able to devote the necessary time to sort of go through what the patient's concerns are, right, and make sure they're all addressed. And so
now, John, you may be tired and you may have achy bones, and you might even have skin that's sensitive to the touch or something, and you may have trouble sleeping. It doesn't mean you have a disease.
That is correct. I mean, these are very much symptoms that the average person, after having gone through a stressful day, most of those describe me after I had an amazing stressful travel day yesterday. But again, I'm not being completely light of that, because
right.
It's not 100% that these are due to a major underlying disorder, and I think that's your important point. Yes.
And what about Lyme disease? Before we leave this subject here, the Infectious Diseases Society of America does not believe that there is a chronic condition requiring long-term regimen of
antibiotics. Yes.
Thank you very much for treatment of that disease, and the doctors who prescribe that actually should be disciplined for doing that.
Right, and what's interesting is that there have been some really good, really interesting papers and studies that have come out over the last few months that have done, I think, as good a job as anyone has of yet of discussing the fact that Lyme disease, when we as physicians are talking about it, we're talking about the active infection with the bacteria, which causes both symptoms but also physical signs, things you can detect on an exam. Whereas folks who have attached themselves to the label of chronic Lyme disease, these are all non-specific sort of symptoms. And as we go on, it seems more and more clear that this has nothing to do with an active infection that's going on right now that you can give antibiotics for. But these are real symptoms, and in some cases they may be sort of the residual of having had the Lyme disease infection that has been treated, but that these are sort of two separate entities. And so we need to approach the people who have subjective symptoms, who have sort of who have been labeled as having chronic Lyme disease, and we need to approach them and try to figure out what exactly is going on and what the best treatments are. Because again, that category probably has numerous different folks with different things that are causing them to feel ill that have sort of fallen into this one category.
Another disease we want to look at that may fall into this category of a disease you may have and not be aware of it and not even know you have, celiac disease. You mentioned it earlier. This is that gets us back into an autoimmune disorder, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And it's true that celiac disease, what this is essentially, you're exposed to a certain protein called gliadin, which is relating to, people don't know what that word is, but related to gluten.
Right.
Gluten is something that's in multiple different grains, such as wheat, barley, and rye.
Right?
It's a protein. And essentially, when that protein gets broken down, it turns out that your body can sometimes make antibodies to that protein, and how that protein looks is very similar to how essentially the surface of certain cells on the inside of your small intestine look. And so these antibodies, which were targeting this protein, then start attacking the inside of your small intestine. And it essentially causes inflammation and damage, which can, in some people, appear to not have any symptoms. In other people, you get abdominal pain. You can have constipation or diarrhea. And in more severely, you can have problems with absorbing vitamins, because essentially part of the problem with absorption when you have this irritation or inflammation inside of the bowel is you can't absorb fats from your foods, which leads you to get fatty sort of stools and gives you diarrhea. And a lot of the vitamins we need, such as the vitamin D, vitamin K, these are things that attach to fat. And so we need to be able to absorb fat to be able to absorb these vitamins from the foods that we eat.
I have an impression, that people who go gluten-free, not all people who go gluten-free have had a diagnosis of celiac disease. Would you agree with that?
I would completely agree with that.
They just believe it's healthier to go that way.
Right. And there are a lot of folks who I've run into who have said that, you know, again, it gets back to sort of that list of maybe even completely subjective complaints like fatigue, pain, things like that. Some folks who had problems with constipation or diarrhea who never got the diagnosis, but they decided it's good to go on a gluten-free diet. So, and they perceive that they feel better afterwards, which is great for them. It doesn't prove that they actually have this specific celiac disease, but glad they're feeling better for sure.
Now, John, before we end our hour with you, I want to spend some time talking about diabetes here in Baltimore City. It affects one out of every 10 citizens, according to the city health department. I mentioned that the Today Show is going to come to Baltimore and spend a year here trying to get the city healthier and doing some things with their weekend anchor people of the Today Show. And one of the reasons they cite is the diabetes here. But how do you know you have diabetes? You just have a gluten test when you go to see your doctor? Or what kind of symptoms do you have with diabetes?
Well, a lot of times, and this is totally appropriate for the topic, because sometimes you certainly can be asymptomatic. And essentially, it's important to back up for a second and state very basically what we're talking about with diabetes. People have heard about type 1 and type 2. Fundamentally and basically, type 1 diabetes tends to be something that you are born with or comes up when you are younger, and your body just does not make enough insulin, which is the hormone that allows you to process glucose and sugar. Whereas type 2, what the issue seems to be for most people, you get it when you're older in life, and the idea is that the insulin you're making, even though you're making insulin normally, your body is sort of desensitized to it. It isn't quite working as well as it should be, so it can't handle the sugar load. What happens is you get higher than normal sugars, and what this can do is essentially, as it's circulating through your blood, it's almost, this is a very bad analogy, but it's one that I like to use. It's almost like you have an increased viscosity, and that's not, your blood isn't increased in viscosity, but you have this higher amount of sugar. It goes to different sensitive areas like your eyes, like your kidneys, like the long nerves going from your back into your legs, and it can over time cause damage. So the big things that people think about when you're talking about, okay, am I having symptoms that might be associated with diabetes? Because you have higher sugars in your body, people tend to say that they're thirsty. They may have problems with their vision. They may have problems with regards to having pain in their legs or their feet, which is called peripheral neuropathy. One description that people often use is that they feel off balance, like they're walking on clouds, because what happens is that damage to the long nerves going to the feet essentially means you actually can't as well sense your balance. And so those are some of the symptoms that people have and complain of. But certainly, leading up to that, there are people who probably have had diabetes or a problem being able to handle sugar for a number of months or even years, certainly, before getting to the point of having any symptoms.
A new study, John, this is very interesting, published just yesterday in Nature Genetics, based on genetic testing of 150,000 people, has found a rare mutation that protects even fat people from getting type 2 diabetes. Quoting here the New York Times, the effect is so pronounced, the mutation reduces risk by 2/3, that it provides a promising new target for developing a drug to mimic the mutation's effects. This is really interesting. Of course, I just wanted to note here that this mutation they're talking about destroys a gene used by pancreas cells where the insulin is made that you were just talking about.
Yeah, that's correct. And I will only say the combination of ZNT8, because that's the name of the ultimate thing this gene makes, and because they're actually putting it in some of the news stories. So that confusing jumble of letters, that's what it's referring to.
So the promise here, we're just about out of time, but the promise there would be down the road, I would suspect.
10 to 20 years, maybe, development of new drugs to prevent or treat diabetes, yes.
Wow. Well, that sounds promising.
It does sound promising. This is a hopeful note we're ending on.
Yeah, we're ending on a hopeful note today.
Yes,
in an hour of talking about diseases you might not know you have. But I hope that you found this helpful, folks. It's always helpful to have John Smarr with us, visiting us again today from Sinai Hospital. He's a specialist in infectious diseases and joins us once a month for Midday on Health. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dan.
And have a great afternoon, folks. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.